Welcome to the Retail Inside Out podcast from Retail Gazette. In this podcast, we take a deeper look at the news, trends, and personalities that are shaking up our industry. I'm your host, Matt Ridout, and on today's episode, we're focusing on how the direct-to-consumer market is changing and reshaping the way we shop. Will we see brands that previously only had an online presence regenerate the nation's high streets in the coming years? Joining us to answer that question and more, we're delighted to be speaking to John Hoyle, founder of Souq, winner of this year's Retail Gazette Awards Direct-to-Consumer DTC Game Changer category. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also sharing their insight into the space is Ian Moore, Head of Services for Excellent Zephyr. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Matt.
I'd like to turn to John and find out, for those who don't know, what does Souq do and what was the inspiration behind launching the company?
Yeah, so Souq rents high street space by the hour with an amazing digital fit out that makes it incredibly easy for you to turn any of our spaces into a bespoke environment for you to do whatever it is that you want. And it's not just about retail, although obviously retail is an important part of it and people associate shops with retail. But it's based on the premise that no one needs a shop 7 days a week. And with our model, you can be completely agile, and reach the right customers at the right time at the appropriate price point. And the reason Souq sort of exists is because I'm a former landlord, formerly at Grosvenor. To me, the way that our industry does business is in the large part absurd. It seems crazy asking brands in a world that is all around agility and flexibility these days. Seems crazy to ask brands to make a bet for a decade and expect them to agree to the kind of terms that we've become so used to. And I think vacancy across the UK is a clear indication that that model is ripe for disruption. And that's exactly what Souq does.
As a landlord, had you been looking at the space previously and thinking like this is just ridiculous what brands are expected to do?
Yeah, I mean, it had been bothering me for quite a long time. You know, when you're part of something that's just a little bit absurd and you can see your customers sort of slightly wincing when you demand things, at the same time as seeing, you know, empty shops in prime retail locations. I actually, I joined an accelerator, which is all about solving big social problems using tech. And I spent 9 months thinking about the problem. Quite quickly, I landed on Souq because, you know, a big part of being a founder, if you're going to do anything, is kind of finding something that you actually know something about. And the landlord-tenant relationship is, you know, probably my only area of expertise. So I needed to create a business that was around that. But really, it was a frustration of mine that allowed me to, you know, resolutely focus on how we could make that landlord-tenant relationship better. And I didn't really appreciate at the time quite how big an opportunity it was. It was very social venture to begin with. I didn't realize that within a couple of years, even with the pandemic and now cost of living crisis, that we'd be dealing with global occupiers quite so quickly.
So I guess it kind of leads me on really nicely into my next question. Why doesn't the traditional real estate model work for DTC brands? I mean, obviously you mentioned, you're having experience with clients who were struggling to make ends meet with the terms that they had. But what kind of specifics make it difficult with the way that traditional real estate works, which Souq is looking to change?
Well, it can work in some places and in some instances. But landlords have had it all their own way for decades. Retail assets have been a really nice risk-free income, which is why all of our pension funds have invested so heavily in them. But that market's changed and no one's been there to challenge the norm. But of course now, as I mentioned earlier, the expectations of all brands, particularly those that started online, are data-led, flexibility, and not the kind of commitment, which is often a decade that landlords have come to expect. And so, you know, mindsets have really shifted. We all have heard a lot about kind of online v offline. Well, that's all merging into one, but landlords haven't really caught up in a way that embraces this new normal. There's this sort of slight weird animosity between the online and offline communities, which needn't exist. And when you also think about it, it's kind of common sense. You know, as I said before, no one needs a space 7 days a week. So if you are one of these traditional brands who's bet on this location for a decade, let's say you're selling fashion apparel, you basically are paying for what is to all intents and purposes an empty shop from Monday through to maybe Friday. And then people come into your space on a Saturday and you hope that you sell enough stuff on that day to make all of that economically viable. And when you think about it in that context, it's mad. You know, sitting in a space relying on a certain amount of footfall to drive viability doesn't make any sense. Why not just cut out those loss leading days or hours, not have to pay for staff, not have huge amounts of inventory sitting on shelves, much of which goes into landfill? And why not think about how you can actually test locations, see if they work, use data to establish whether they're successful, and bounce around as the data tells you to, given that, you know, right now, none of us really know what the future of work even looks like. So we don't actually know where customers are going to be. It seems crazy, and I think people acknowledge that, to take any sort of bet that is longer than a year. And most people are looking for much more agility than that. So that's the appeal to D2C, guys, alongside the fact that it is very expensive and challenging to get noticed if you're only online. So if you can blend an IRL experience in an agile way with all the good stuff and all the benefits of being online, then you're in a fantastic position to grow your business.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And I suppose, obviously the impact of the pandemic, which you alluded to, has completely changed the way that we, interact with shopping. And obviously for a period of time, we were doing everything online. And obviously when things started to ease, there was an urge to go, back to physical space.
I think we've been perversely very lucky with timing, because I think what the pandemic's done is not necessarily supported us, because it's been incredibly hard. But what it has done is it's changed the attitudes of pretty conservative stakeholders on both sides of our marketplace. You know, when you're dealing with landlords, they don't want things to change. They really want bankable occupiers that are committed for a decade. And they're quite resistant, with the exception, obviously, the amazing landlords that we work with. They're quite resistant to that change, and they're scared of it. And there's a good reason they're scared of it. They don't want to cannibalize their own marketplace. And as I mentioned, a lot of our pensions and big insurance companies are tied up in it working. But traditional retailers aren't much better in terms of being innovative. You know, they've got kind of real estate teams that have done things a certain way for decades. And again, and what I've learned as a startup founder is everyone says they want change, but when you ask them to actually embrace it, it's often a very different story. So, what the pandemic and now, the 2-year recession that we're about to enter has done for us is said to people, look, you actually do need to do something different now, because if you don't, your businesses are going to die. And, they say necessity is the mother of invention. Well, the benefit for Souq, and it's sad to see the UK in the state that it is today, but the benefit for Souq is that actually all of these norms are being challenged for the first time, in some cases, ever.
We've seen, the decline of our high streets across the country. Obviously, I guess the thing that Souq can do as well is perhaps reinvigorate that, providing access to those spaces that are sitting empty or are underutilized. Would that be an accurate thing to say?
Yeah, I mean, that's the bit that excites me most, is that it's kind of criminal that we allow spaces to sit empty. And there's all sorts of stories that I could tell you about landlords who can't be bothered to do things because maybe their building's listed, so it's exempt from business rates, and actually bothering to fill it is not worth their while. For me, the assets that sit within our communities should be owned and accessible by the people that live around them. And that's why I say Souq is about retail, but in the right hours of the week. And the rest of the time, it's about giving people the tools that they really own to do whatever else they want. You know, some of the most exciting things that have happened are not really about making money. A guy proposing to his girlfriend in one of our spaces, having turned it into a shrine to her. You know, the baby massage, the old people's cinema, the hobbyists, the student startups. You know, that for me is much more powerful than Uber using our space, even though that's fantastic for our profile. I love obviously having Jägermeister doing activations in our space, and I love, you know, all the big brands that pay the bills. But what's best about their involvement is that they're underwriting the use of hundreds, thousands, almost unlimited amounts of other people to do anything that's good for community. You know, and it's just my frustration that the real estate industry doesn't really recognize community. They talk a lot about it, but it doesn't have a covenant strength, doesn't pay the bills, so it often just gets neglected. And what Suit does is blends the ability for big brands and smaller stakeholders to exist in a really nice, financially sustainable way.
I guess as a business, it's kind of creating a community hub rather than just a shopping experience.
The opportunities are kind of unlimited. You know, estate agency, you see all these basically offices sitting on the high street, deeply inefficient use of space. Car showrooms, you know, why not use our spaces on an hourly basis for appointment-led car stuff? Retail banking, you know, that's really important. We all know that the retail banking model is flawed. Why not do that in the lunchtime slot? That's the only time any of us go to the bank anyway.
True, yeah.
So, you know, it's just challenging all sorts of slightly accepted absurd norms that have evolved over many decades, and wrapping it all together in a really complementary way. And I don't, you know, it is obviously clearly about community, but it's really, and it sounds quite boring, but it's about utility. Mm. We sell time, not space. And when you start thinking about it, our real estate assets in that way, it actually seems crazy that we've ever done it the way we have. And there's all sorts of reasons that the retail model has evolved physically. A lot of it's about fulfillment, stock, and obviously the desires of landlords to create those sorts of deals. But surely, we know there are enough shops. We're approaching 100,000 empty shops in the UK. Surely there are other ways to engage than the traditional way. And that's what Souq's trying to be the pioneer for.
Turning to Ian, obviously Excellent Zephyr is a company that provides services to DTC brands. So you're at the front line, I suppose, of understanding what challenges that businesses are facing. So I guess what I'm interested to find out from you, Ian, is what are the common issues that are facing brands and retailers that you speak to?
I think just following on from John, I mean, that's a very intelligent, I mean, assessment of where the high street is right now. And it's fantastic to understand the insights of what Suit have found and what they're doing. So it's a brilliant job that they're doing. I think to talk about technology and D2C brands, there was a huge explosion in the pandemic. And basically, if you put a website up and you put some branding on there and you put decent product on, you know, people had no option but to go to those websites, and online purchasing and e-commerce became, you know, instinctive for people to do because their time was limited and they couldn't go anywhere and they had the opportunity at home to browse and really, you know, shop and had disposable income at the time. I think what we're now seeing is, with retail space opening back up and restrictions being lifted and the economic uncertainty coming, it's really affecting the spend online. And so you're having to work extraordinarily hard as a D2C brand to, as John said, attract the attention to get that spend back up to where it was. So for us, we're working with D2C brands, really helping them on a number of fronts, actually. And one of the challenges is data for them. Is getting really clean data sets through. And that's from a blend of basically the online world and bringing in those orders and tracking the customers and being able to distinguish which customers are profitable. To also now, how do we bring in the customers in store and trying to blend those two. And that horrible term, omni-channel, which actually I agree with John, is, you know, there are some absurd words that come out in phrases, and that for me is, it's a horrible thing, because basically you're just saying, do I want to spend my time in store doing something, you know, special, or do I want to buy something online? Those things should be the same. And I think if you blend that with the offering that something like Souq does with really smart technology, that actually should be a way that you can purchase what you want when you want to get it delivered to a place and time that is convenient. So I think to answer your point, Matt, it's about data and then just getting that data into the systems and making sure that it's, you know, you can report on it and it's integrated. So that's probably where we're at the moment, I think. But it's changing. It is changing.
Are there particular areas where, you know, at the moment, especially coming out of where we were and in where we were living in an online world and moving more into sort of a face-to-face or as you said, I mean, it's cliche, but hybrid model. Are there particular areas where you know, people are struggling to find information or to access information on their customers?
When we talk to our customers and we talk to prospective customers, we talk about process first and foremost. And we talk about three core processes that they do. We talk about order to cash. So however that order comes into their business, whether it be via a store or whether it be online, it's then about getting payment for that. We talk about procure or to pay, which is basically just being able to buy stuff and then pay for it and matching those two together. And the final one then is record to report, which is basically just being able to, anything that you do in the business is then report on it. So if you're talking about the first one, the order to cash piece, is basically if you've got an order that's taken in store or online, it's being able to track that order. And that's absolutely critical to your business, because if you don't know what orders you've got coming in and then fulfillment of those orders, it's then a problem. So tracking the order all the way through to fulfillment. And then the other counterpoint to that is the returns. And returns now, if people are buying something online or in store, it's basically they should be able to return that effectively and efficiently and get a refund. So for us, it's working really closely and making sure that the retailer understands that process and being able to then support that so that it's a very efficient, clean process. And therefore, they can at any point say, where is my order? Where is the return? What stock have we have? You know, that visibility and control, really. So I think that's probably where most of our focus goes in at the moment, is just order tracking and returns.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, as we're talking about that, you know, the hybrid sort of model, is that something that you see as going to be the focus for the next few years? Is there's going to be need to be attention spent in obviously the online and e-commerce world, but also providing physical spaces where people can interact with products or have a certain experiential, you know, connection to a brand or a retailer?
Yes, I think it's a short answer to that. I think I can't disagree with anything that John has said, and I'd like to. And for me, it's a very, very powerful message that he's putting out there, because there's a lot of absurdities out there, and we shouldn't be talking about online versus offline. The two are merging. They're here now. What that looks like going forward, I don't think anybody really knows, because there's so much uncertainty, and you know, things move at pace, and they really do evolve. And some retailers embrace that. You know, if you're a D2C that was born online, you're now probably thinking, you know what, wouldn't it be great to be able to get a high street space at the times that I need it? I'll give you an example of that. The upcoming golden quarter, call it what you want, peak period, this now is the time where if you're online, if you could have a physical presence. You see companies like Gymshark just opened up a flagship store. Now, they're a brand with a huge profile, really good revenue, but there's some brands that would like to replicate that but don't have the budget. So to be able to have a physical presence for peak, to be able to run up to that, to put, you know, their best foot forward and put on, you know, the best view of themselves in the store, I think would be fantastic. So again, I'm of the opinion that that is what the future will look like, but it's going to take a while to erode those horrible norms out of the way.
Coming back to John now, obviously you mentioned earlier, but Souq is more about, you know, space than just a shop, and that you've obviously had some really interesting uses of the space. When we're talking about Souq as spaces, obviously you've expanded now since 2019. There's multiple locations across the country and your footprint is quite widespread. Do you have a space that you're most proud of?
I suppose if I had to choose, I'd probably go for the first ever Souq, which isn't open anymore. because it was the first one that proved that there is enormous demand across all sorts of different occupiers for this sort of solution. And it was a defunct shop next to a restaurant in a sort of not particularly exciting part of Cambridge. And I put 17 screens on a wall, had to kill a lot of rats. And, you know, it was a really, really basic solution. But as every kind of startup founder will tell you, when you look back on those minimum viable products and kind of prove something and get away with it, it's a sense of enormous pride, because it's what we did there was unrecognizable from some of the amazing state of the art spaces that we have today. But I think one of the things that I sort of learned from that is that actually people don't need things to be perfect. You know, the existing retail sector in real life, you know, obsesses about brand and fit out and, you know, and the quality of what they're putting out there, shop windows, et cetera, et cetera. Spend a fortune on it. You know, if you went to a Mary Portis, that's all she'd talk about. And I just don't think it's that important. And you can see probably brand and marketing agencies getting very upset about that. But what we've discovered is this whole sector of essentially Gen Z who are pretty happy with a scrappy solution, and they will have, and I'm not saying super scrappy now, it's very, very sophisticated, but you get what I mean. Like they don't believe in paying a third party to tell them who they are or what their brand should be, because they consider that deeply inauthentic. And when you think about it, they're absolutely right. Their personality sits at the front of whatever it is that they're doing. I mean, the Depoppers are a brilliant example. I didn't even know what Depop was when I started Souq, and now they're our biggest customers. They're 20-something girls, for the most part, who are ardent businesswomen, frankly, making tens of thousands of pounds an afternoon selling rebadged secondhand goods. And you know, they don't need a shop full-time. They just want to bounce around and engage with the customers that they've built online, but that really benefit from seeing them in real life. And I think that's just a really interesting insight into the future of our high streets, because, you know, I hear quite a lot about people bashing Gen Z. Oh, Gen Z are idle. Oh, they don't want to do jobs, etc., etc. And there may be a small amount of truth in that, like every generation. I was bloody idle when I was 20 something. But I think the truth is actually that they've got very different choices that they can make. You know, you don't need to get I think it was a £5.50 an hour job at Gap that I had when I was sort of in the holidays at uni, because you can make £10,000 on your Depop store or your Vinted or whatever. And I think if we don't embrace this huge potential army of entrepreneurs that's coming from that, you know, that's sort of section of our society and is only going to grow, then we're going to miss out on the brands of the future. You know, if to create a super dry, you needed to be an expert in real estate. You're not going to need that in the future. You're going to be able to just be good at doing what you do, whether that's designing fashion or promoting yourself or just being an influence in some nature. It is a totally different world where new startups can challenge established brands really quickly. And we're kind of seeing that with Gymshark, you know, challenging almost like the Nikes of this world.
When you launched that space in Cambridge, obviously going from, you know, hitting the ground running with a completely new idea, was it difficult to convince people of the value of it?
Well, yeah, trying to change the way people think about anything is really hard, which is why, you know, changing a sector, which is what we're trying to do at Souq, is something that it takes a huge amount out of all of us in the team. As I mentioned before, people say they want change. They don't, in my experience. About 1 in 10 actually want change, and no one wants to lead change. So it is challenging. Having said that, we've got to, until August this year, zero marketing spend, which shows the appetite. You know, that site in Cambridge, I was selling it at £10 an hour across the board, and it was busy straight off the bat. And that was just me flyering with my poor first ever employee who was, you know, incredibly helpful. So, you know, it has been, you know, we're starting to get national recognition now, and that's through word of mouth. Yeah, I'm not going to claim it's been easy. It's been extremely hard, but you would expect that when you're trying to do something that's as different as this.
And have any of the tenants gone on to open permanent?
Yeah, it was a good example of actually not a Depopper, but it's kind of a jewellery brand called Bijou de Mimi, who progressed out of one of our Oxford Street spaces into a space in central London nearby, and then actually have given that up and they're coming back to us. There's not huge amounts of people opening permanent stores right now anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, there are some that have taken the kind of, I think, slightly perverse view that it's a great time to do deals with landlords, which it is. But most people are like waiting to see where the cards land when will the world ever come back to normal? What are we in? The perma crisis that seems to have been ongoing since June 2016. But it is something that landlords love about us. I mean, you have to consider what we're doing from a landlord perspective too. You know, we make more money than a traditional lease, which is the thing they're most interested in, no matter what they say about other things. But also, it drives kind of unique footfall in hours that maybe the sites are not busy, from people who shop in adjacencies, which is really important. It embraces community in a really, really powerful way. And it's good for placemaking in terms of, you know, we're a digital art gallery. In the worst case scenario, the spaces are open and doing something engaging. So, you know, there are all sorts of different appeals to different stakeholders. And we're just trying to embrace all of them.
And I guess in you know, following on from that, do you envision a future where there's a souk in every high street across country? Is that sort of like the end goal, is to have a space that serves every community?
Yes, we want to be everywhere. We believe we can be everywhere. There's certainly enough vacancy, and increasingly there's more and more demand from occupiers to take that space. Because when you think about it, I mean, Nike have customers everywhere. But they don't have presence in, other than through kind of third parties that they're trying to retract from, they don't have a high street presence in all sorts of places. But, you know, there's a Nike customer in Rochdale, in Penzance, in Inverness. And we can provide a platform that gets those people into any of those places. And it's more than that. You know, we're aiming to sell a product or a service from every country in the world, because people are interested in different engaging brands. And so if you make it easy for people to jump across borders, we're already seeing South African brands really loving getting into the UK because they can sell in pounds. It's much better than selling in rand. So the ability to cross-pollinate experience and brands is really important to us. You know, gone will be the days where you come back from holiday with some, I don't know, T-shirt that you bought, and all your friends are like, "Oh, where'd you get that?" And you're really smug because they can't get it because they haven't been to Greece. You know, why not bring those brands to places in a way that's going to cost them, you know, less than, a few hundred pounds, maximum a few thousand pounds to test different markets and different customer bases.
Thinking about how you know, DTC and retail is changing. What do we expect from the next 5 years? If you could make some predictions.
I think it's very, very difficult. I mean, if you just look at technology, the trends, the pace of change as well, it's really hard to nail any one point down on that. I mean, you've already seen the rise and fall of kind of the e-commerce software providers. You know, take things like Shopify, you know, they absolutely explode in growth. They're now cutting back on spend, cutting back on jobs. But I think what you're seeing is a leveling out of you know, demand for those technology platforms. And I just think it's really hard to define what the future holds, because it's, you know, we're seeing exploding IT trends that are coming out. So like microservice integration, that's a key one we see. So if to say like, you know, if trying to connect everything and automating it, that's probably where we're seeing most of our future growth coming up. Monolithic process, monolithic providers, you know, ERP, absolutely relevant because it gives you backbone and visibility and all the things I was talking about earlier. But I think if I had to sort of hang that on everything, probably integration automation. So how can people do more with less, you know, target their spend really efficiently and really make the data that we were talking about earlier work better and be much cleaner and sharper for them. So if I had to say anything, that would probably be those two areas. And probably, you know, how it would be used in this ever-evolving landscape that Sukh and John are doing a wonderful job in.
In terms of advances in automation and people's preferences around shopping, do you see kind of any major advancements being made in that area?
I think for us, it's more about the automation of business process within a company.
Right.
And I, John said earlier, you know, you think people are doing things really slickly. When you get under the covers and you see actually they're not. There's still a lot of manual process going on, still a lot of spreadsheets that exist and support businesses that people spend hours sifting through and another person will change and something will be lost. So I think for me, it's really doing things better and smarter internally with the same people you've got, because given the financial uncertainty that we are in and we're now looking at, it's, you know, people are probably going to be drawing in their spend and looking to say, right, what can we do better? So I think it's just really automating those internal processes better. So simple ones, if you receive lots of stock invoices and you've got reams of paper on your desk, you're lost in this mountain of paperwork. If you can automate that, put it onto an email, get a piece of software to then scan that in and match that to a purchase order to an invoice and then pay it automatically for you, that's a lot of time saved right there. It's dull, but it's necessary. So I think for me, that's probably where I think, you know, it's maybe not the most sexy or exciting thing, but it's truly effective. You can make it work properly. So I think definitely that automation piece is key and integrating it to bring that all together. Yeah, I think from where we're headed.
If you had one piece of advice for a retail business that was looking to get into the direct-to-consumer sector, I mean, what would that piece of advice be?
Plan. And make sure that you are ready to take advantage of what it can give you. Because if all your systems are not connected in some way, shape, or form, or your data isn't connected and comes through cleanly, it can be incredibly painful and incredibly time-consuming. So all the gains you think you're going to get from this additional sales platform can be lost and it can be very expensive. So just make sure that it's just, you know, it's true of any business truly, but just, you know, make sure you plan it out, make sure you test it thoroughly and make sure that you're ready then to take advantage of what it can offer you.
Excellent. That's good advice. And John, turning to you, the same question that we began with Ian. What do you see kind of being the major challenges, but also the major opportunities for retail in the UK in the next 5 years?
So my answer is kind of heavily physical retail weighted, but I think there's going to be the sort of demise of the old financing model behind physical retail, which was that sort of private equity model that someone like Philip Green took huge advantage of and probably gave a bad reputation, where you're just expanding the same brands across every high street, really paper thin margins. Model based entirely around scale, but actually quite a vanilla customer experience. I think that's going to really start fading, and particularly it already has fallen out of favor with the younger generation anyway. And I think you're going to see a proliferation of challenger brands who may have started online and have big followings, and are kind of the opposite of what's a good example? Maybe a Next, or maybe let's say one that's getting a lot of grief at the moment, a Shein type model, you know, heavily focused around sustainability, ethics, authenticity. And those brands will grow way more quickly than the traditional ones have, and with a far lighter capital requirement than the private equity model. And what that means, you know, for landlords who own all of these assets is having to think about engaging in in very different ways. The old model where they give a Debenhams a £1 million up front to fit out their shop in return for a 25-year lease. You know, those days are gone. And it's actually kind of, it's a little bit scary about what that means for our economy, given how much money is wrapped up in retail assets. You know, none of us have an interest in seeing landlords fail because of the potential shock it could cause and impact it could have for people. But their business model is under enormous pressure. And it'd be interesting to see how a deeply inflexible sector can react to that over the next, decades. It's not going to change anytime soon.
So, you know, Ian, obviously we've spoken about, you know, the things that brands need to consider in terms of, you know, before launching and, you know, obviously the planning involved. But what are some of the costs involved for a brand who's looking to enter DTC?
If you were a physical brand in a store, as John's alluded to, you've got the merchandising, you've got that, and it's how you present that store, fit it out, how you put the window together, how you then, you know, create the in-store experience. The same is true to a lesser extent if you're doing a D2C. Your website, the way it looks and the way it feels, the way you navigate it, really needs to have a lot of thought. And, you know, if you're engaged with a very good agency, they will spend a lot of time about the look and feel about that. There's then obviously all this spend that needs to go with that to support that. It's a very effective marketing strategy. You know, how do you attract people to that website? And there's a lot of, you know, different ways to do that. So you can pour a lot of money into that budget. And if you pour a lot of money into it and then the website that you're actually being attracted to is poorly worked, poorly designed, it's not particularly nice to look at or to use, that is, you know, is wasted. So I think it largely depends on what it is you're doing and what it is that you're trying to do with your D2C brand. If you're testing the water, you know, then it can be a pretty cost effective. If you are looking to ramp up, then again, I would just go back to, you know, you can pour as much money in as you want, but it may not be effective. It needs to be thoroughly thought through and cleverly planned. And then our bit was really doing the plumbing behind that to connect it to all the other systems that you have. You know, having this great website and bringing people to them, if you click on the button, you think, brilliant, my order's gone, and it doesn't go anywhere, and nobody picks it up, and, you know, it's not fulfilled, and you don't receive it when you're being told, then it's a waste, you know. So you've only got that opportunity to do that once really well, and people are very fickle and won't come back to your website. The load times are poor. So you really do need to look at every aspect of the performance of that, and sometimes, again, and I keep saying this a lot, going back to John's point, people look at the online world as this wholly different place, and sometimes they haven't taken it seriously. You know, they don't think the same rules apply. Well, they do. You know, it does really need to be thought through and planned properly. So I think people can undervalue and under prepare for a D2C site, and I think, you know, the cost can be excessive if you don't get it right and really think about it. So be clear about what you want the site to do. Be clear about what's realistic and what your expectations are and the return, really, to when you think you're going to start seeing that. You get some examples. You know, one of our customers, Trinity London, is that's really what they've done. They launched in the pandemic and they've been a real success with that. And it's all about their site. But, you know, I can tell you there's a lot of work goes on behind that to make it the way it is. So, again, be prepared, be clear. But, you know, It's not a silver bullet to everything, that's what I would say.
Well, that was a fascinating look at how the DTC space is adapting and changing the way we shop. You've been listening to John Hoyle, founder of Souq, and Ian Moore, head of services for Excellent Zephyr. And I'm Matt Ridout. This is the Retail Inside Out podcast from Retail Gazette. You can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.